KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The possibility and the ability for fires to become active is high probability.
For firefighters on the front lines around LA, high winds and dropping humidity mean fires could still spread and spread fast.
Today is Monday, January 13th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, big city fires used to be common.
Then fire codes changed and urban planners learned how to design differently.
I look at it, it's like watching polio return. I mean, we solved this problem. We understood what it took to prevent cities from burning.
Also, how the debate over H-1B visas is playing out in one city with a large Indian American population, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Corporations do this all the time. They replace their experienced workforce, bring in new college grads, for example, to cut costs.
And the Tiny Desk Contest is back.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Los Angeles, firefighters battling the two biggest blazes are worried about winds that are predicted to pick up again. The National Weather Service is forecasting wind gusts up to 70 miles an hour through Wednesday. LA Fire Chief Kristen Crowley.
As this wind event continues, we urge the public to stay diligent, to stay ready, as the danger has absolutely not passed. Please adhere to any evacuation warning and orders immediately.
The blazes have left at least 24 people dead, with dozens listed as missing and thousands of homes and businesses destroyed. CAL FIRE says more than 40,000 acres have burned and forced about 150,000 people to evacuate. The cause of the fires remain under investigation. Containment of the Palisades fire is still just 14%, and officials say it's spreading toward Brentwood. Meanwhile, older people in Los Angeles are especially vulnerable as wildfires continue to burn. Kelly McEvers has more from a Red Cross shelter where many older people evacuated after the Palisades fire, the largest and most destructive one.
Sarah James is 76. She's worried that she's so sleep deprived she's stopped making sense.
I close my eyes and think that I'll go to sleep. Instead, they pop open in 20 minutes and I'm wide awake.
Her cotmate at the shelter, Francoise Myra, who's 64, says she's pretty sure her house is gone. She doesn't even know where to start to rebuild her life. She's having trouble logging into her accounts.
My password book is in ashes at home. I wrote it all down. My password book was like 2 inches thick.
Volunteers here say older people who were already struggling with physical and mental health are struggling even more now. For NPR News, I'm Kelly McEvers in Los Angeles.
The U.S. Supreme Court is refusing to hear a challenge brought by the state of Utah over control of millions of acres of federal land. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports the case could have allowed the transfer of sale of some of those public lands.
Utah's case was always considered a long shot. A litany of prior court rulings has upheld the federal government's right to own and manage federal public lands in the West. But the current court's willingness to overturn precedent had legal experts saying Utah could have a shot. State Republican leaders who filed the suit say they're disappointed, but add they think federal land managers under the incoming Trump administration will be more favorable to the concerns of locals. Coal and oil and gas companies have accused the Biden administration of being too restrictive. Environmental groups say the Supreme Court's refusal will ensure that federal public lands in the West aren't sold off to developers. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Special Counsel David Weiss is slamming President Joe Biden for pardoning his son Hunter on the grounds that the prosecution was politically motivated. Weiss says that's a baseless accusation. The Justice Department released Weiss's final report on his years-long investigation of criminal allegations against Hunter today. Hunter Biden was convicted in June of federal gun charges for lying about his addiction to crack cocaine when he purchased a gun. 3 months later, he entered a guilty plea to tax offenses for failing to pay at least $1.4 million in federal taxes. Sentencing was expected in December in both cases. Scientists in Switzerland have developed batteries powered by fungi. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on this new breakthrough in which fungi generate electricity.
The fungal batteries are made using a 3D printer. Scientists at the Swiss research institution EMPER mixed printing ink with fungal cells. They combined two types of fungi, yeast fungus and white rot fungus, whose metabolisms together cause the right chemical reactions to generate electricity. The batteries are biodegradable. Rather than leaving behind toxic waste, as most conventional batteries do, once these are spent, they digest themselves from the inside. For now, the amount of energy they generate is small. The scientists say they could supply power to sensors for agriculture or research in remote regions. Now the scientists are focusing on making the battery more powerful and long-lasting. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We begin this hour here in Los Angeles County, where wildfires continue to burn. The damage has been colossal. Thousands of homes have been destroyed, and officials have confirmed at least 24 people have been killed. That number is expected to rise. And for more on what is next for communities in Southern California, we're joined now by NPR's Jason DeRose. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
So where do things stand now, both with the fires and with the weather conditions?
Well, Elsa, over the weekend and into today, fire crews were able to eke up the percentage of containment on the two largest fires, the Palisades Fire on the west side and the Eaton Fire on the north of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But there are real concerns they might lose ground this evening and tomorrow. And that's because after a few quiet days, winds are expected to pick up dramatically this evening and into tomorrow.
Right.
The National Weather Service says we'll see sustained winds of about 50 miles an hour in places through Wednesday, and gusts could reach 70 miles an hour. Now, while that isn't as bad as it was last week when the fire started, it's still bad, and it's compounded by the fact that the humidity's dropping.
Okay. So it's getting drier, the winds are picking up. What do those conditions mean for firefighters out there right now?
Well, the winds mean the real possibility that the fires will spread and spread fast. Rob Clark is a fire behavior specialist with CAL FIRE focusing on the Palisades.
Even though you might not see activity on our fire currently or very isolated pockets, the possibility and the ability for fires to become active or new fire starts is high probability.
Those winds blow embers over fire breaks, sometimes across major highways and into neighborhoods, and could ignite more fires on homes and businesses. CAL FIRE warns that there is still a lot of fuel out there, bone-dry trees and brush and grass, and exhausted firefighters who've been battling these blazes for a week now.
Nonstop. What kind of help are they getting? Do you know?
Well, quite a lot. At least 9,000 people are battling these fires right now. Firefighters from surrounding counties, even surrounding states, have arrived and are working with CAL FIRE. Also, fire crews from Canada and Mexico are here in LA County to aid local crews and are going on duty today. Mm-hmm. And California Governor Gavin Newsom has sent an additional 1,000 National Guard troops. They're doing things like working with local police to keep people from entering the very dangerous burn zones and evacuation areas and to prevent looting.
Okay, so a lot of people from all over trying to protect us. Jason, I do want to ask you, because you normally cover religion, and I'm so curious, what are you hearing from the communities you usually report on as part of your regular job? What are they saying now?
Well, Elsa, at least a dozen houses of worship have burned so far, including 9 churches, 2 synagogues, and a mosque. Bruce Freeman is the rector of St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Pacific Palisades. He says 13 of the 21 buildings on their campus burned down.
We will get through this with each other. Even if all the buildings go, we're still St. Matthew's, because we are the church. We are the community.
Freeman says about three-quarters of his congregation lost their homes. Freeman's own home, the parsonage at the church, as well as the homes of two associate rectors at St. Matthew's, also burned down. But they seem resilient so far. In fact, all three of the clergy and a lot of the congregation of St. Matthew's showed up at a nearby Episcopal congregation in Santa Monica on Sunday morning for church.
That is NPR's Jason DeRose. Thank you so much, Jason.
You're welcome.
When natural disasters like these fires in Southern California strike, animal rescue operations kick into high gear. KQED's Rachel Miro reports from an animal care center in Pasadena, not far from where the Eaton Fire is burning.
In the week since the Eaton Fire began to rage, Pasadena Humane took in more than 400 animals, including the kinds the nonprofit usually cares for, dogs, cats, bunnies, but also...
We had 8 cockatoos come in, we've had goats come in.
That's Dia DuVernet, the CEO of Pasadena Humane.
We had one family in Altadena that had a pony, and they walked the pony down from Altadena to our shelter.
DuVernet says the initial surge of pets deposited by evacuees on the run gave way shortly thereafter to those found and brought in by animal search and rescue teams.
We're seeing burns, we're seeing singed paws, we're seeing singed whiskers, we're seeing smoke inhalation problems. We had one dog come in that appeared to be a dark gray dog, and after we gave it a bath, we realized the dog was a white dog.
We found Roxy in the intensive care unit.
That's Roxy. Wow, Roxy still looks pretty gray. Hi, sweetheart.
These animals don't have the energy to bark or meow. They just lie there, exhausted.
We also think that there will be some animals that miraculously survived, and especially cats. They're going to be very frightened. We will be putting out traps.
Outside in the courtyard, I'd say it's a zoo, but there's clearly a method to the madness. There are 150 employees, including 5 full-time veterinarians, working around the clock, but also scores of volunteers. They greet people pulling up in their vehicles to donate food, bowls, blankets, carriers, and so on. The volunteers sift through it all, like Connor McPherson of Pasadena, who, with a Chihuahua Terrier mix of his own at home, couldn't stand by knowing how great the need is.
I just felt that, you know, I needed to help in some way, and so the fire, you know, I just felt compelled to help.
Over the course of the next few weeks, some evacuees will come back to claim their pets. Others will have to rely on Humane to hold on to their loved ones until things are sorted out. Still other animals will need new homes. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in Pasadena.
Between Billie Eilish, Chaka Khan, Doechii, Chapel Roan, and dozens of other musicians, 2024 was a big year for the Tiny Desk Concert Series. It was also a big year for the Tiny Desk Contest. That's NPR Music's annual search for the next great undiscovered artist. The contest celebrated its 10th anniversary, and the judges picked Sacramento artist the Philharmonic as the winner.
I was told I could be anything that I wanted to be.
The Tiny Desk Contest is back for 2025. It kicks off tomorrow, and series producer Bobby Carter talked with our co-host Ari Shapiro all about it.
So, starting today, artists can enter the contest for the opportunity to play a Tiny Desk concert. They've got to live in the U.S., be over 18 to enter, but how do they win? What are you actually looking for?
Yes. So, basically, artists submit a video of themselves playing one original song, as they would right here at the Tiny Desk, behind a desk. Listen, we want your best. This isn't a live performance, so perfect it. You know, if you didn't feel it the first time, run it back until you get that gut feeling that you've done something great. You know, our judges will sift through thousands of entries to find the best of the best. You know, we're looking for something fresh, something singular, any genre, something we haven't heard before, whether that's a new sound, a new perspective, something that's gonna make us dance or make us sing along, something that's gonna make us laugh or even cry. We're just looking for something very special.
Let's talk a little bit about the judges, because I know the lineup changes every year. Usually you've got some bold-faced names. Who's in the lineup this year?
Yes. We got a power-packed panel of 10 judges this year. Of course, we always have artists who've played the Tiny Desk, in the past. This year we have Hooray for the Riff Raff, Audrey Nuna, and we got La Russell from the Bay Area.
Hey, 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 P-Lo, tell him bring a bass bag.
But we also have some Tiny Desk producers. We have DJs from NPR member stations. And this year, we're going to have some industry experts. So trust and believe, you know, this team, we're going to honor each and every entry with some dedicated eyes and ears.
That is high pressure. So what does the winner get? An opportunity to play a Tiny Desk concert, of course.
Yes,
but
yes.
What else?
Yes, of course, you're going to play the real desk here in Washington, D.C. We're going to take you on a 10-city tour. And we're going to pair you with a mentor, right? Because once you get this big exposure, you got to know what to do, how to move. So we're going to pair you with an industry insider who's going to help you kind of navigate this weird thing we call the music industry.
And then there's often this rocket trajectory. I mean, past winners have gone on to achieve such incredible things. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about what the Tiny Desk Contest has done for their careers?
Yeah. So our very first winner, Fantastic Negrito, he's gone on to win a handful of Grammys.
A handful. No biggie.
You know, Tank and the Bangas, they, you know, that's light work, but Tank and the Bangas, they've been on the Grammy stage as well. They were nominated before. Our winner, Galen Lee, she's composed for Broadway. And of course, we have last year's winner, the Philharmonic, who just flat out blew up.
All right, hear my words, all right? Come out from the valley of the shadow of death. Take this in, I promise that you'll never run out of breath. Live your life, because sometimes I know it's hard to respect. It's when we hurt.
His Tiny Desk concert reached 1 million views on YouTube within just a few months. All right, so just imagine being an indie artist with 1 million eyes, with 1 million pairs of eyes on your work, right? It's life-changing, and it's a life-changing start for the Philharmonic. And I think we're ready to take another big leap this year.
Well, I hope somebody listening to our voices right now is going to be the one. Bobby
yeah.
Carter, host and series producer of NPR's Tiny Desk, announcing the 11th annual Tiny Desk Contest, which opens today. Artists can learn more and submit their song by February 10th at npr.org/Tiny Desk Contest. Bobby, have fun going through these thousands of submissions.
Let's get it. All right. Good to talk to you, man.
You too.
Support for NPR and the Tiny Desk Contest comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card VentureX. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from Lagunitas Brewing Company, since 1993, committed to challenging the status quo and brewing innovative beer, featuring a range of craft brews and non-alcoholic options. Learn more at Lagunitas.com.
But if you look at the people that are better than me, trying to find a way around this power scheme. What's it all mean? 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 What's it all mean?
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Confirmation hearings begin this week for a number of President-elect Donald Trump's nominees. It is the first major opportunity for the public to hear them answer tough questions about their qualifications and how they plan to manage some important government agencies. Here to talk with us about what to watch for is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Great to be with you, Elsa.
Great to have you. Okay, so give us the lay of the land. What's scheduled for this week?
Well, several hearings as Trump really is trying to get his team at least mostly in place or close to it when he's inaugurated next week. You know, these hearings are important because of the Senate's advise and consent role. Mm-hmm. So all the nominees have to go through this, through these public hearings with the relevant committees. The committees then vote on whether to recommend them for the full Senate, and the Senate then votes, and only a simple majority is needed to confirm.
Right. Okay. And I see they kick off tomorrow morning with the hearing for Defense Secretary nominee Pete Hegseth. Tell us what to watch for there.
Yeah, the hearing tomorrow for Hegseth is one a lot of people are going to be watching, but there are also lots of other hearings on Wednesday for nominees for some other very important positions. Attorney General with former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, mm-hmm. Secretary of State with Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Homeland Security with South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. All critical jobs to what Trump wants to do, whether it's how the Justice Department, FBI, criminal investigations are conducted, deporting immigrants in the U.S. illegally, how the U.S. is viewed overseas. You know, Hegseth's hearing is going to probably be the one that's the most closely watched because of all the controversy around him. Right. That includes whether women should be in combat, for example, and he's likely to face some tough questioning from several senators, including Democrat Tammy Duckworth from Illinois.
Okay, so tough questions are expected for Hegseth. And so far, you know, we've seen one of Trump's nominees withdraw. That's Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. How likely is it that anyone else's nomination could be derailed at this point, you think?
Well, we'll see how they handle the questions and the scrutiny. I mean, Hegseth is the first big test for the team Trump wants to put in place. The most controversial of the other nominees are Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence and Kash Patel for FBI, but both of them haven't even had their hearings scheduled yet. They're still meeting with senators. Stepping back here, I mean, there's been a longstanding belief that presidents should be able to pick their teams, barring, you know, major issues. So lots of senators are likely leaning toward allowing the majority of Trump's nominees through. And we have to remember that many people likely don't know who many of these nominees are or have even formed, you know, views solidly about them. So these public hearings are going to be a critical test for these nominees to prove they're both qualified, can handle the scrutiny, and it's a little bit of a test of Trump's political capital as well.
Well, as we're watching these hearings, Domenico, who do you think are the most important senators to have our eyes on during the questioning?
Well, some of the usual names here are going to be, you know, most critical. People like Maine's Susan Collins and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, both moderates. But there are a few senators, far fewer senators now in office than 2016, who might oppose Trump. So the likelihood is at the end of the day, Trump is probably going to get, for the most part, the team that he wants through. And I'm curious, though, to see if and how many Democrats cross the aisle to vote for Trump's nominees, even the less controversial ones we could see, you know, and where they decide to make stands. Because there's a big question here with Trump coming back into office about what the Democratic resistance is going to look like. We're not seeing, for example, the same level of protest as during Trump's first term. It could be that some are just simply tired. Also strikes me that Democratic elected officials want to be more strategic and focused about where they push back and waiting to see what Trump actually does.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thank you so much, Domenico.
You're welcome.
In recent weeks, U.S. conservatives have been debating the country's H-1B visa program. The program accounts for just over 45% of annual work visas. It authorizes temporary employment to foreign-born workers, often in technology and engineering. Supporters say the program helps businesses find skilled workers not readily available in the U.S. workforce. Steve Bannon disagrees. Speaking on his War Room podcast, the one-time political advisor to President-elect Trump called on the incoming administration to end the program entirely.
We want it gone. We demand that it's gone, and we're going to fight for this.
State Department data shows that workers from India received the majority of H-1B visas issued last year. So we asked Steve Harrison from member station WFAE to tell us how this is playing out in one city with a large Indian American population, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Many of Charlotte's skyscrapers were built in large part by two massive financial institutions, Bank of America and Wells Fargo. Together, they employ roughly 43,000 people in the region. Those banks need thousands of IT workers, and some of those jobs have been filled by people who once came to the U.S. on H-1B visas. In North Carolina, people born in India are the second largest group of foreign-born residents after those born in Mexico.
So I'm Amit Mehta. I've been living in Charlotte since 99. I came to this country on an H-1B visa to work for a company that was multinational.
Now a U.S. citizen and a cybersecurity manager for one of the city's banks, Mehta has seen how Indian Americans have gone from the rank and file to being in charge.
Now I look around and, my last three bosses were Indian Americans. Right? You're talking about C-level people running major businesses.
He thinks visas for highly specialized workers are critical.
That's a competitive advantage that we have as a country. We should not give that away.
As Bannon and others have attacked the H-1B visa program, newer Trump allies have been some of its most outspoken defenders. That includes tech billionaire Elon Musk and former GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, who has said the system could be improved. But responding to Bannon on X, he said that visas are needed in part because American culture has, quote, venerated mediocrity over excellence. Born in Ohio, Ramaswamy is one of many people of South Asian descent picked by Trump. Sean Shamugathan, who works in Charlotte's IT sector, is heartened by Trump's appointees.
And he is a New Yorker, right? So he naturally tend to work with all kinds of people.
He came to the U.S. on an H-1B in 1993. A Trump voter, he believes the H-1B program is rife with problems.
What's happening right now, it's got abused quite a bit, no question about it.
He thinks some employers aren't necessarily looking for hard-to-get talent, just inexpensive talent.
Corporations do this all the time, right? They replace their experienced workforce, bring in new college grads, for example, to cut costs, right?
He thinks instead of employers sponsoring visas, a point system where employers compete for qualified workers would ensure salaries remain competitive because the visa holder could have negotiating power. As for Mehta, he thinks the federal government should make sure H-1B recipients are not being paid less than their American colleagues, a main criticism of the program.
I still remember I was paid more than some of my peers, and I was not being kind of underpaid, right? And the company was not using that to just bring cheap labor.
In his first term, Trump pledged to end H-1B visas. But speaking to the New York Post last month, he called it a great program. Steve Harrison, NPR News in Charlotte, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
A new opera imagines two black women politicians competing to become Houston's new mayor. Hear from some of the creatives trying to change what opera looks and sounds like on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As rates of suicide increase for certain groups, a new look at what might help prevent these deaths.
Having higher minimum wage, having greater unemployment benefits, things like that showing evidence of preventing suicide death.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Rental home prices here in Los Angeles are spiking as the wildfires force thousands of people to look for new housing. David Wagner of LAS reports a listing on Zillow shows that the rent on one property increased nearly 86% since September.
The furnished four-bedroom home in Bel Air was listed Saturday morning, days after the fires broke out, for $29,500 per month. That's up from $15,900 in September. The home's rental agent, Fiora Aston with Compass, said she told her client,
"People are desperate and you can probably get good money and you should move out. She has a second home." So she moved into her second home.
The listing was taken down a few hours after the interview. Journalists for the New York Times and the LA Times are spotting other listings with huge price jumps, and housing policy experts say the fires will likely drive up rents for a long time to come. For NPR News, I'm David Wagner in Los Angeles.
Almost 4 years after entering the White House, President Joe Biden delivered one of his final speeches today about America's place in the world. This marks the last week in office for Biden, as President-elect Donald Trump prepares to return to the White House next week. Biden says his administration made strides in restoring America's credibility on the world stage and has proved the U.S. remains an indispensable partner around the globe.
Today I can report to the American people, our sources of national power are far stronger than we were when we took office. Our economy is booming, although there's more work to do. Our technologies, from artificial intelligence to biotech, quantum, and to advanced semiconductors, are the envy of the world.
Biden still holding out hope to get the remaining hostages released from Gaza before he leaves office. This is NPR. One of the nation's largest meatpacking companies has agreed to pay $4 million to help address child labor violations in the industry. NPR's Scott Horsley tells us, this has the agreement between JBS and the Labor Department.
The agreement comes after a government investigation found a JBS contractor illegally hired children to perform dangerous cleanup work overnight at the company's slaughterhouses in Colorado, Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska. JBS has agreed to include a zero-tolerance policy towards child labor with contractors in the future and set up a hotline for reporting suspected violations. The company also agreed to provide scholarships and other assistance to young people and communities adversely affected by past employment practices. A Labor Department official says companies like JBS have enormous leverage to prevent child labor. She credited the meatpacker for accepting responsibility and taking steps to remedy the problem. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
More hospitals across the country are implementing restrictions after seeing an uptick in flu cases. More than 63,000 flu-related hospitalizations have been reported amid high levels of respiratory illness in over half the country. Healthcare systems in North Carolina and Minnesota are among those restricting visitors, as high levels of respiratory virus puts a strain on the entire system. CDC says the flu season is already responsible for almost 3,000 deaths. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Wildfire is the word we tend to use when we talk about what Los Angeles has been dealing with the past week. But Lori Moore Merrill, the U.S. Fire Administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, she used a different word when she spoke to NPR this morning.
These are conflagrations. These are not wildland fires with tree burning. These are structure-to-structure fire spread.
Conflagrations. Well, they may have started at the suburban fringe, they did not stay there. Stephen Pine is a fire historian and an emeritus professor at Arizona State University. I asked him how a wildland fire differs from an urban fire.
Basically, what we're seeing is you begin getting houses ignited. Most of the houses on the fringes will ignite by embers. And if there are high winds, if it's the middle of the night, if there are too many, it can quickly overwhelm the capabilities to suppress those fires. And then you get a transition into an urban conflagration. It's eerie to look at many of the photos and see how much of the vegetation survived. And the houses are vaporized.
You're talking about some of the photos we've seen where the house is just a smoking ruin, but there's a perfectly green bush sitting beside it.
Yeah, next to it. So these are not being propagated by the vegetation, but it is essentially the energy released by the combustible house that is carrying the fire to the next one. So, you know, everything in a city we build, so we can, in principle, control all of that.
Yeah, there would seem to be some advantages to trying to control a fire in the city. The urban infrastructure, there are fire hydrants.
It's curious because during the settlement period, the U.S., our cities, our major cities, burned about as often as the surrounding countryside because they were made of the same materials. There were lots of ignitions around. Open fire was used everywhere. But we broke that cycle. In the early 20th century, I think San Francisco, 1906, after the earthquake. And then we really didn't have urban conflagrations until across the bay in 1991 when Oakland burned. And that sort of inaugurated a new era. And I look at it, it's like watching polio return. I mean, we solved this problem. We understood what it took to prevent cities from burning, building codes, fire codes, material standards, all of those things. And now it's coming back.
So let's apply all this to a city like, for example, LA. What should we do to prepare?
You can certainly harden houses against the kind of ember storms. I think the issue is going to be what we've got decades, if not a century, of building without this kind of problem in mind, and we're not going to be able to retrofit all of it immediately. And so I think the big question is, how do you rebuild? And the instinct is always to build back as quickly as possible, probably as much like it was as possible, so people don't feel as dislocated. But if you do that, then you're just recreating the same problem.
That's fascinating. We've just heard from California Governor Gavin Newsom weighing in along those lines, saying we are going to try to make it as easy as possible for people to rebuild.
Well, of course. I mean, what's he going to say? But if you really are interested in solving the longer-term problem, the way you control fire is by controlling the landscape. And that doesn't mean you nuke it. It doesn't mean you clear-cut it. It doesn't mean you pave it. It means you organize that landscape in ways that allow you to survive fires.
So if you were rebuilding LA, how would you do that?
Well, I can give you suggestions how I would do it, and I can guarantee that nobody's going to accept them. You're talking about a lot of people, and you're telling them they're going to have to change where and how they live. And in some ways, you know, you can model fire as a contagion. So how would you deal, say, with COVID or the flu? Well, you wear masks to prevent aerial transmission. That's like hardening houses against embers. And then you clear your vegetation around the house, a short amount. Well, that's social distancing. Mm. And then you have to get the whole group to do it. Otherwise, your neighbor's house is going to irradiate yours, even if you've done all the work. So this is suddenly, it's looking very complicated.
You're heading me toward a final question, which is just the long view on this. I know you've thought about fire for a long time. You were a wildland firefighter yourself back in the 60s and 70s, right?
Yep. Well, fire is not just a chemical process. It's also a relationship. You know, fire has been our constant companion as a species. So in that sense, I'm optimistic. But right now we've made our best friend our worst enemy. And that is going to require a lot of change in thinking and understanding. And I want to believe we can do it. I've got grandkids, and I want a future for them. But I have to say the record has not been all that hopeful.
Fire historian Steve Pine. He is emeritus professor at Arizona State University. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Saber teeth of saber-tooth cat fame are pretty fearsome. They're canines, like humans have, but elongated to a sharp point that juts out below the jaw. These fangs have evolved at least 5 times in predators that are now extinct, but there's been something of a mystery as to why. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has this story.
Generally speaking, canine teeth have 2 main jobs.
They need to be sharp enough to puncture and slice things. But on the other hand, they need to be strong enough to avoid breakage when they're doing that job.
That's paleontologist Emily Rayfield of the University of Bristol. Saber teeth, an extreme canine, are so long and pointy that they're a bit of a conundrum, she says. They seem so lethal, but also fragile. To understand how saber teeth balance that trade-off, the team analyzed nearly 100 different canines, from saber-toothed cats to panda bears. First, they estimated their strength using engineering computer models.
So whereas you can do this for cars and bridges, you can also do it for teeth.
Then, for puncturability, they created stainless steel models of the teeth that bit down into a gel.
It's kind of like a really stiff jello. And you can imagine that really sharp teeth don't need much force to go through the gel, whereas really blunt teeth need a lot of force to go through the gel.
Combined, these 2 methods revealed the relative strength and puncture performance of all these teeth. Saber teeth came out on top for puncturing.
They'd all evolved towards this kind of shape, which made them really good at puncturing, but to the point where they were actually as good as they could be to resist breakage. So any increase in resisting breakage would mean their puncture performance would get worse.
That specialization led to huge advantages in capturing prey, which is likely why these teeth evolved so many times. For example, it helped saber-toothed cats become an apex predator of the Pleistocene. But the results, published in the journal Current Biology, suggest it also could have been their downfall.
It made us think about whether they'd actually kind of reached a sort of pinnacle in performance that meant that when the environment changed or when there were new predators on the scene, like humans, for example, these animals were simply not able to adapt and change.
Saber-toothed predators are now all gone, so saber teeth could represent a cautionary tale of evolution. Getting too good at one thing just might lead to extinction. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Italy, a very public debate has begun over technology to keep government and military communication secret. At the heart of this debate is the world's richest man, Elon Musk. His company, SpaceX, is in advanced talks with the Italian government about the sale of encryption systems made by his firm. For more on this, we're joined by NPR international correspondent Ruth Sherlock from her base in Rome. Hey there, Ruth.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So explain to me a bit more what exactly this deal is and why it's become so controversial.
Yeah, well, this is a discussion between Italy and Elon Musk's SpaceX business for a $1.5 billion five-year deal in which Italy would make use of Starlink satellites to secure communication in its military and diplomatic services. But this story has been blowing up on the front pages of Italian newspapers here because of this personal friendship that's formed between Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, with Elon Musk and with incoming President Donald Trump, an opponent. See this, therefore, as a real blurring of the lines between friendship and politics and business, and Musk now stands to make a lucrative business deal at the same time as he joins the Trump administration. And Meloni has, of course, however, denied that the talks have anything to do with her personal friendship with Musk or with Donald Trump.
Interesting. So the relationship between Elon Musk and Donald Trump has been much discussed, much reported on here. Tell me more about the alliance that's forming between them and Italy's prime minister.
Well, they all see themselves as united against what they see as the villains of the political left. And Musk and Meloni have a lot in common. They have this love, for example, of the fantasy epic, Lord of the Rings. The Italian right wing has kind of appropriated that story by J.R.R. Tolkien since the 1970s, and Meloni has continued that, quoting from the book in her political speeches. And Musk and Meloni are so friendly that after photos were published of them gazing at each other at an awards ceremony in New York last year, Musk felt he had to actually publicly say that he has no romantic relationship with the Italian Prime Minister. Hmm. He tweeted that he'd gone to the ceremony with his mum. And with Donald Trump, you know, Meloni and the incoming president's views very much align. Here's Rachel Rizzo. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Europe Center.
They're contrarians, they're, quote, anti-woke. They are, some would say, too strong on things like immigration, and they're all pretty nationalistic. And so they all sort of make natural allies with one another.
And this alliance is obvious in how Meloni is one of the few world leaders to have been invited to have an audience with Trump at his home in Mar-a-Lago in Florida this month. And during this visit, Trump called her a fantastic woman.
Ruth, just step back and give us the wider picture. Whatever happens with this particularly controversial deal, how might all this impact America's relationship with Italy, with Europe more broadly?
Well, you know, from the Italian perspective, Italy might be hoping to get some reprieve from things like Trump's promise to slap tariffs on imports from European Union countries. And many in Europe are calling Meloni the Trump whisperer and saying that Italy may become the go-to country in Europe for the White House. A lot of this, Mary Lou's, really comes down to a test of how much friendship at these powerful levels can ultimately affect the future of a country. That's the real question here, and I think the answer is going to play out in the coming months and years.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock in Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Sea otters are some of the cutest animals in the world. We are journalists and we deal in facts, so I have to allow that this is not exactly a quantifiable statement. But what is a fact is that they're helping defeat one of the most invasive species in the marine world, green crabs. Now, if you live on the West Coast, you may know about these crabs. They destroy marine habitats and aggressively hunt and eat small prey that other creatures in the ecosystem need to survive. And while coastal states have spent millions trying to manage green crab populations, ecologist Rieke Jeppesen and her team discovered otters can be a big part of the solution. She researches green crabs at Elkhorn Slough Reserve on the California coast and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I understand that you have been studying green crabs for almost two decades. You have studied them in their native habitat, Northern Europe, where you're from, and you've studied them on the U.S. Atlantic and Pacific coasts. Can you just tell us a little bit about the problems that they can cause?
Yes. The green crabs can cause various problems in the near coast ecosystems. They can damage oyster beds, which are valuable commercially. They can also damage seagrass beds. And seagrass beds, at least in Elkhorn Slough, California, provide a valuable habitat for commercially valuable fish species and also other crabs. And then last, green crabs can also consume small mudflat invertebrates that otherwise would have been available for shorebirds to eat. And the shorebirds use the estuaries as migratory stopovers. So the green crabs really have the potential to exert a disproportionately large effect on the ecosystems they invade.
I mean, what you're describing sounds like a pretty massive problem. And I want to understand, how can these cute and cuddly sea otters help solve it? How did you stumble across this?
I started studying the green crabs back in 2003 for my dissertation at UC Santa Cruz. And we thought that green crabs were taking over Elkhorn Slough and the west coast of the US. What we found, though, as the study progressed, so in 2003, we were looking at a rapidly growing green crab population. About a decade later, the population remained high, but another decade later, the green crab population had diminished and remained at a low level. At the same time, Elkhorn Slough is the only California estuary where the sea otter successfully has reestablished a substantial population. And the sea otter has been increasing in population size while the green crab was decreasing and remained low. So given that we do long-term monitoring and we studied the green crabs and our colleagues studied the sea otters, we overlaid the two graphs and we found this striking pattern of when green crabs are high, sea otters were low, and when sea otters were the highest, green crabs were the lowest.
What is it that makes these sea otters such efficient green crab predators?
Sea otters rely on fur for insulation, as opposed to seals, which rely on blubber. Blubber insulates much better, so sea otters have to eat a lot to keep warm. So it's basically a weasel in the water, and weasels are super active. They have a high metabolism. So to sustain sea otter health and keeping warm, they just need to eat a lot. And we did a high and a low estimate of how many green crabs can the sea otter population actually consume over the course of the year. And it's somewhere between 50,000, but maybe up to 120,000 green crabs.
Am I correct that sea otters are an endangered species?
The sea otter is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
Okay, got it. I guess I'm curious then, does that create a bit of a catch there, given that they're endangered and yet they are these sort of efficient predators that are able to help provide some sort of control to the green crab population?
Yes. It's really a win-win scenario if we can support a native threatened species, the sea otter, which in turn then helps control an invasive invertebrate. So in other words, you can say that sea otters are our assistant managers of the estuary for invasive species control.
That was ecologist Rike Jeppesen of the Elkhorn Slough Reserve on the California coast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, in this next story, we're going to be talking about suicide. It's an issue that policymakers are increasingly seeking answers to, as certain groups have seen alarming increases in suicide attempts in recent years. NPR's Katia Riddle reports on new research that suggests many economic and social policies that are not explicitly focused on mental health can also prevent suicide.
More states are trying to address growing concern around suicide by passing new laws. Jonathan Pertl studies public health at New York University.
So we looked at the number of bills passed at the state level every year that mentioned suicide, and we see that going up from a little bit over 50 in 1993 to over 300 in 2023. And these are bills passed, right? So a lot of state legislative activity.
But despite this increase in effort to prevent suicide, there hasn't been consensus on what kind of public policy is the most effective in reducing risk. These researchers looked at which states had the lowest rates of suicide and what public health strategies they have in place. They found that some of the programs that helped the most had nothing explicitly to do with suicide prevention.
Having higher minimum wage, having greater unemployment benefits, things like that showing evidence of preventing suicide death.
States that improved economic security for people had lower rates of suicide. This paper is published in the Annual Review of Public Health. It's a peer-reviewed journal. Researchers also found lower rates in states with more access to mental health support. Laws around substance abuse also matter.
And then in terms of policies that limit access to alcohol and tobacco, we see some pretty strong evidence.
And access to guns. Younger people are especially vulnerable to suicide. States with stronger penalties for parents who don't store their firearms safely had lower suicide rates. Michael Lindsay is dean of the School of Social Work at NYU. He also worked on this study.
It is this sort of caustic environment that we create, whether by intention or otherwise, that is really the accelerant, if you will, to suicide risk.
Lindsay and other experts on this topic say they're hopeful these findings will give policymakers some direction.
I think that's what stands out for me, is that, you know, we can do something about it with more information and the political will.
Political will, he says, to save lives. Katia Riddle, NPR News.
And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool, customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from the...
Old Stranger Jenny saved up all her pennies. Straight to the bank she would go. The sharks would hound her hands around her, but none could get her door. Jenny's fella was a slick high yellow, sent away to jail one day. He cried for bail and turned real pale when I heard Jenny say, I've got what it takes, but it breaks my heart.